Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Adam McNeil. This is a special series of roundtables on African American studies. We're going to be talking to scholars about old trends and new directions in the field, along with what it means to be an African American studies scholar. Today, we have our first interview of the roundtable series. And y'all, let me tell you, I'm excited. This person is no stranger to these airwaves. Her name is none other than Dr. Ashley Farmer, the first three-time guest and my 55th interview within the series. I'm excited. And Dr. Farmer is Assistant Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and History at the University of Texas at Austin. And today, instead of discussing a book, Dr. Farmer is on to discuss my favorite read of 2018, her Black Perspectives piece titled Archiving While Black. And Black Perspectives is the award-winning blog of the African American Intellectual History Society. Welcome back for the third time to the program, Dr. Farmer.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Most definitely. And so to dig in, what prompted you to author this piece?
You know, it's interesting because I actually started the draft for this piece maybe 2 years before it actually appeared on Black Perspectives. I was finishing up some of the archival work for my book, Remaking Black Power, and I was visiting Howard University's archives, and then I was also visiting other archives at Duke and in New York at the public library. And I was just thinking to myself about the differences between how I was treated in an archive that focused on Black people and was largely run by Black people versus one that was not. And then the other thing I was thinking about as this piece was kind of percolating was that I had a class at Duke University that it took students into the archive for. And, you know, it was a challenge, I think, because it seemed as though students being there, particularly students, I had an all Black class being there, you know, was not something that they were used to. And I've experienced similar things in taking other classes to the archive at other universities. So, you know, not just to call out Duke is the only one. And so I was thinking a lot about my own personal experience of being in the archives. And then also, you know, my job as a historian and a teacher is to introduce as many students as possible to the archive. But I wondered about how comfortable my students were really feeling in that kind of space. So, you know, I started a draft of this and I put it away and I did another draft and I put it away. So it just took me quite a while to kind of you know, figure out what I wanted to say. And it wasn't really about these, you know, individual isolated incidents. It was kind of about the architecture of the archive and thinking about how it's just not a space that's designed for Black and brown people. And, you know, much like the space of the academy is not really designed for Black and brown people.
Yeah. And that's why for me, the piece was amazing because it allowed for readers who may or may not be historians to really understand what it means for not only historians, right, but Black historians to do the work that they do. And so with that, can you talk to us a bit about maybe situations that have happened within your own time as a scholar, as a historian in the archive, and because you detailed a couple times in the piece. And so a good part about us, you know, doing this kind of thing is people can just go and get it, right? They can listen and literally, you know, go get it without having to have this paywall, which is a whole thing that people are talking about on Twitter right now.
Yeah, so a couple of things that I mentioned in the piece, and then, you know, I mentioned when I speak about the piece, you know, in kind of longer form through, you know, keynote addresses and stuff, is one, just the actual space of the archive. Sometimes we don't think about like how much it is to go into that space, be literally surrounded by pictures of dead white guys usually. And then on top of that, I've been in spaces where, you know, there's racist paraphernalia that they're displaying as part of their collection. And that doesn't mean that that stuff should not be displayed, but it was really very much devoid of context and kind of in the space in which I'm working. So my, you know, body and my mind in that space looks very different from a white person going into that space. Other examples of issues I face in the archive is there's kind of a lack of training in terms of who, you know, what the archival holdings are for African-American history. And there's a great set of archivists that talk about kind of the finding aid as also a tool of this kind of discrimination. And what they mean by that is that whoever classifies the finding aid chooses the keywords and chooses what to highlight. That not only makes the collection known in one certain way, but it also obscures the other things that are embedded in that collection. And so sometimes I would go to an archive, you know, and I was sure of what they had because I had done my research ahead of time. But the archivist was very, you know, sketchy or didn't really understand the holdings they had in Black history. And here I'm talking about archives that are not obviously devoted to Black history. Sometimes I've heard even that I won't find much there, or the things that I'm researching are you know, marginal. I've even been asked to step aside so that the archivist can help somebody else who they felt kind of, I guess their research more strongly fit within that. And then kind of the final thing I think about a lot when I'm in the archive is the surveillance of the archive. So certainly I understand that you have to keep an eye on your materials and you need to make sure that your materials are being handled with care. But there's a lot of surveillance and processes that go into the archive that a Black or brown person who's constantly being surveilled feels. And the suspicion with which is met that I don't understand the procedures or that I'm not complying with that surveillance is not the same suspicion that's being heaped upon my white counterparts when I'm in the archive. And perhaps even, I guess, the most elementary kind of understanding of it too is just usually I'm the only Black person and, you know, in the staff or those patrons visiting, and also typically the only Black woman.
Right. And for me, I definitely have had something, you know, a couple things even similar to me with some of the work that I've been doing, where you'll go into, like, you know, doing work on slavery, going into an archive and literally in the finding aid not having anything pertaining to slavery, or if you're looking digitally, that there's no metadata to signpost, okay, that I'm engaging with materials that would be that should to the public be shown as slavery, but, or as slavery documents and plantation documents, but because the metadata is not there, who's going to know? And so that's why, you know, this particular work is so important to us all. But then also, you know, you talked about the training that you've done with some of your students and classes in various spaces. So can you talk to us more about that? How do you help to equip your students at UTE and the ones that you've had over the years to I don't know if deal with, you know, the stresses of it is the best way, but it's what I got for words right now.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, so one of the things that I think is really important, no matter what history class you take, even if it's like a big lecture class or a small kind of research class, is just the introduction to the archive. Because how can I be teaching you the craft of history if I don't, you know, expose you to that? So, you know, I try to help my students understand what an archive is by having the archivist come to the classroom first before they even ever step foot in the archive, so that they can understand that there's somebody there they're supposed to talk to. They can get kind of a rundown of the rules ahead of time and understand the procedures and things that people are asking them to do are the procedures that are expected of everybody. But also this is serving the purpose on the other front of kind of familiarizing the archive with my largely Black and Brown classes so that they understand that there are going to be groups of these people coming into their archive and they pay tuition there and they have a right to be there as much as anybody else or any other scholar. And, you know, it's really quite a wonderful experience to see students get to, you know, hold something or see something that, you know, they never thought that they would see or understand that kind of makes the history more real to them. So it's very important to me that each of my students feel empowered to go and do that and that they have a right to be in that space.
And I think that's one of the most important aspects of the entire piece is the empowerment aspect that you're providing, not only to the readers within the form that's coming in through Black perspectives or the one that get picked up by the Chronicle, but also the fact that you're empowering your students to be able to feel empowered in these spaces, to ask questions, to really investigate. And to really get mm-hmm. down to what it means to be a historian. And for you, you know, with that being said, what does it mean for you to train, you know, the next crop of historians?
I mean, I consider it my honor and my privilege. I think that there is, you know, like these key kind of humanities and social science disciplines, history can give you the lens through which and a framework through which to not only understand the past, but also understand the world around you. And we all know that the people who write the history kind of get to shape these narratives in whichever way they see fit. So I love being able to introduce a new set of people into kind of critical thinking by way of showing them all of the things that they have not been told or been left out. Often my students in my big introduction to African American history class say that my class could be called All Your Faves Are Problematic. But really, you know, what I'm, you know, bigger than that, I'm trying to train them to say, you know, not only can history show you a clear understanding of how we got here, but it can also give you the skills with which to interpret the world around you, whether that be, you know, when somebody posts something on Facebook that looks like a map, but what are they really leaving out? Looking at a timeline, looking at who went back and read something and if people are quoting it right or they need to go back to the source. So I think when I'm training historians or training people at the very least to have a history lens, I'm training them to be critical thinkers, and I'm hoping that I'm giving them kind of a skill set and a framework and a vocabulary with which to talk about what they see going around them in truthful and meaningful ways. But also, you know, I think, what are we doing this work for if it also doesn't incite people to behave differently? One of the things that I constantly tell my students is that, you know, it's okay not to know. We are all born woke and understanding everything. And I'm glad that you are, you know, taking it upon yourself to be able to learn. But once you know something, you can't unknow it. And the mark of a thinking individual is to behave differently once one knows that stuff. And so one of the things I think that historians really have the power to do is to help people know. And in that knowing, hopefully shift their behaviors in the world. So that's how I kind of think about history and kind of tangible action in that way.
And that's great because, you know, it makes me also think about what this piece has really represented since it came out, I guess, around like over a year ago now, year and some change. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm not the first person to discuss this with you, maybe in the podcast forum, but definitely not just in general. And so for you as the scholar who has written, who wrote the piece, what have you thought about the reactions that you've had to it?
The reactions have ran the gamut and been really interesting. You know, a lot of people said that, you know, obviously they too have experienced some form of that down to, you know, I don't know, it's a, you know, kind of shock that such a thing could exist or that I could call archives racist or, and really what I'm calling is the structure that we have created that is called the archive, which is a, you know, man-made fundamental construction as having bias built into it, both in its structure and also kind of its what it collects and what it does. So there's been surprise from that all the way to like, thanks for articulating what I've also felt. But I also want to point out some of the responses that I've gotten specifically from archivists. So just in response, you know, I spoke about my experience at Duke, you know, at the top of the podcast, but I have to say that I met with, I came into contact with some of the archivists at Duke, speaking about this piece last August at the Society for American Archivists. And I would say that those archivists had taken it to heart the most and had actually created like a little pamphlet about how to decolonize and kind of rid white supremacy from the archive and a list of things that they were doing to change it, which I thought was pretty phenomenal. I've also heard from other archivists who have said that they have tried to bring this piece up, you know, within their archivist circles or perhaps at whatever archival institution that they work at. And it's been met with a lot of pushback again, because this idea that somehow archives are neutral, but also those who brought it into their circles have said that they've liked that they've kind of gotten an entree into that. A lot of the thinking is about how do you collect things and how do you be ethical about the materials, which is really, really important. And I'm glad we're having those conversations, but you know, I think people had thought maybe less so, or had maybe been less focused on how whether or not they were making the archive an inclusive space, or in what ways were, you know, you just inheriting a place that perpetuated these biases, but kind of need to point them out and move forward. So it's really run the gamut, but I've really been the most kind of excited and heartened by the archivist's response to it and their willingness to say, you know, we hear you, and here's some concrete ways that we can make this a space that Black and Brown people feel comfortable in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And that is the kind of service that is just so amazing. And I want to thank you for, because, you know, you're aiding, you know, not only those who are in the pipeline like myself and other grad students, but also those who have not been what we can call born historians, right? You know, they may be alive, mm-hmm. but they have not had that birth, you know, into the historian profession. And so, you know, I just want to say thank you and kudos for the work that you're doing, while also asking you, you know, you talked about the, you know, excitement. What excites you about being a historian? What excites you about all of the work? This is the third time in less than 2 years, right? You're one of my early, and I don't think I ever told you this, but the first time I interviewed you, I was actually sitting in the Museum of African American History in the actual church. I worked there, and my mom had come in. And so I had actually, my mom wanted to go walk around, but I was like, Mom, I got to do this interview. Got Dr. Farmer, you know, okay, I got to make sure this gets done. And so I literally sat in where Mariah Stewart actually spoke, right? In the bottom room. And so, I don't think I had ever, I'd seen you a lot of times since then, So what does it mean for you to do the work that you do and produce the work? You know, you were just, I think you were at a book festival with Dr. Kendi and another panelist over the weekend. So you're a busy person, but what does it mean for you to be a historian and a Black historian at that? Black women's historian?
I mean, history's just the coolest, man. I guess there are ways in which history and kind of the archive has been ingrained into me that I didn't realize this. I mean, you know, just for listeners who think, you know, folks that do this podcast have it all figured out. I was a French and Spanish major in college. I did not think I would be a professional historian. I also was pre-med. I think I also thought for a second about being a lawyer. So I didn't have the straight route where I always thought it was going to be. But one of the things that was great about my training at Spelman College is I had great history teachers that told me, you know, the kinds of questions you are asking about the world can be answered through history. And they really opened my eyes to the idea that someone could, you know, spend their life doing this for a living. So the things that I love about history, I love the nitty gritty. I mean, you know, as complicated as a relationship as I have with the archive, I love archiving. I love the act of discovery. It's very much kind of like a treasure hunt. I love the idea of taking pieces and finding these little morsels of people's lives, particularly Black women's lives, and putting them together and stringing their story and kind of recreating a life before your eyes. And then, like I said, I love what history empowers us to do. I think often, or I can think of nothing in my own life. And I think often when I think about the activists that I study in terms of the things that they cite, is that you need an example. You just need to know that somebody somewhere in the world has been through this. Somebody somewhere in the world has tried this. Somebody somewhere in the world has, you know, believed the same things that you did. And I think that writing that down and sharing that with the world allows people to have that somebody and hopefully go out and, you know, do something different in the world. And I mean, I love teaching. I mean, you know, we all hem and haw about teaching just because I think, and what professors are really saying when they're saying that is sometimes we're frustrated with all the other things that take place that get in the way of us really digging into teaching. But there truly is nothing better than walking somebody through that kind of self-discovery for helping them have that aha moment. You often get students who I think end up in history classes, particularly a Black history class, because they suspect they haven't been told something or that something's not right. And giving them kind of the lens and the framework with which to talk about it and move forward differently is, you know, it's an honor. It's a privilege to be able to do that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm also just a dork at heart. Like, I just like
yeah. this stuff. No, for real. No, that is so real. That is so real.
It's not even that noble. It's just simply like, I've always been a geek and a nerd. But one of the things that I think is probably an important story to share in relationship to the archive that I think will be pertinent for our story is that sometimes you don't realize you're on this path until well into it. So I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. Both my parents are graduates of Fisk University, historically Black college. There. And I used to have to do research papers in middle school and high school. And one of the things that I only realized probably in the last 5 years is that my father would pick me up after school every day and take me to the Fisk archive. And he's like, you can write about something in here. You know, this is your option, you know? And I understood it as like, you know, okay, you have to go to the research paper and check out books and stuff. But what that was really doing was my parents saying, you know, not only should you be steeped in your history, but let me also show you how an institution and an archive can embrace you and show you, you know, the life around you and help you make sense of, you know, the life that you live here in Nashville and your family and also Black people more broadly. So there was a way in which I was made to be comfortable in an archive as a child that I don't think really registered with me until I was an adult. But also then why it's so important for me to emphasize the importance of exposure to an archive and the importance of all people from all walks of life being comfortable going into that space.
Most definitely. And, you know, that's, You touched on so much, and it made me think about the first time that I even went into an archive. I think I don't know if I was 10 years old, but I went to the library with my cousin back in South Florida, and we went to go look through old Jet magazines because they had them on a microfilm. And I had no clue that that was microfilm, but you know, then you start to realize that moment of, I've been here before, but much, much younger in a very, very different form of life.
Yeah.
And it just shows that, as you just mentioned, you sometimes don't know all the time where you're, you know, what your own story within the archive is until you literally listen to folks like Dr. Ashley Farmer to discuss archiving while Black, and you realize, oh, snap. I have been here before because I have, you know, been situated similarly. And, you know, it's just really awesome to hear about all of the stories about where you are now and the experiences that you had. But you know, I can't let you off without asking you this particular question, though. What intellectual community helped mold you as a scholar? Because you had just mentioned your formative years, but talk a little bit about your time within graduate school and how that that helped to hone you as well. And you had mentioned Spelman College before. You know, homecoming was last week as well. So
yes, it was a
good time.
Yes. So I, you know, going to an historically Black school, and particularly Spelman, is unique in that, you know, the curriculum is not just Black focused, but Black women focused. You know, it taught me how to orient myself to the Black experience. So even though, for example, I was a French and Spanish major there, I didn't learn, I think I had one semester of kind of like regular French history. Everything else was about, you know, the Black diaspora who spoke French by virtue of colonization and slavery. My study abroad experiences were in places where Black people who spoke French and Spanish were. So it kind of taught me that it's okay to center things in that way. I actually didn't take a history class until my last year there. And it was actually with Jelani Cobb, who at the time, you know, worked at Spelman College. And he was formative in kind of teaching me not only Black history, but again, also teaching me that history could answer questions and kind of helping make sense of the world. And, you know, most importantly, at a place like at HBCU, like Spelman, I was also nurtured for just helping get to the process of graduate school in a way that I think sometimes is more difficult at bigger institutions. As far as, you know, graduate school, I actually went into graduate school thinking I'd focus on Black women in the Caribbean and, you know, moved more into being an intellectual historian and, you know, studying Black power. And really, the people that did that were the activists themselves. I took a Black intellectual history class and started interviewing Black activists and theorists. And, you know, they captured my imagination with their stories of how they thought, and I just kind of had to tell it. And I had to make sure that people understood these women for the theorists and the thinkers that they were. So, you know, it when you look back on it, it kind of can all make sense. You know, it certainly didn't make sense as I was doing it. I always want to emphasize that these kind of linear trajectories aren't always what we think they are. But I can see how I took pieces and was nurtured by different communities to kind of get where I am today. But that's also why it's so vitally important, I think, to make sure that all these spaces that we enter into are, you know, places where people feel similarly and feel nurtured.
Exactly. And one of the aspects that you had just mentioned that is still, depending on where you're situated within academia, mm-hmm. is still deemed a bit controversial as far as evidence goes. You had mentioned oral histories and we're talking about archiving. So mm-hmm. you know, let's talk about that in the brief couple moments that we still have.
Yeah, well, you know, I also, I was thinking about this as we were talking earlier. So, you know, I'm talking about the archive as a very traditional physical place, but, mm-hmm. you know, I also think that we should trouble the notion of the archive in and of itself too, right? Especially when we're thinking about Black history, because the archive is really all around us. I mean, a perfect example would be the Jet magazines that were probably on your grandma's table that now become, you know, part of the microfilm. And oral histories are a huge part of that. There's a way in which we teach people that somehow the written word is more objective than oral history, as if those written texts aren't just as mediated, you know, by different forces as oral histories are. And then also, if you're going to do a history of a people who were literally barred from writing and reading for many years, then those same kinds of evidence and sources can't function you know, in terms of the written text and the way we would for perhaps other communities. So I think oral histories are vital. I think I'm kind of on a crusade to stop kind of marginalizing them as, you know, less than or additive sources, particularly when talking about Black people or Black women. And I also, you know, want people to think about the archive as generally as generously as possible. Archives are certainly the places that we go to in institutions with archivists that collect stuff. But archives are also in all kinds of community spaces and social media and other places all around us. And we should not solely privilege the ones in kind of institutions, because that kind of recapitulates some of the issues about privilege that I'm talking about in the Archiving While Black piece.
And it's a piece that, believe me, y'all, you need to go read. it is going to really, no matter where you are in this whole thing, historian, scholar, lay person, you need to go read it. And it's also another reason why I wanted to have Dr. Farmer on here is because she has an important role with the African American Intellectual History Society, which is the budding, amazing, not only intellectual community, but organization for the study of the, you know, the global Black experience, right? It has African American, but it's just, it's not just talking about folks within the space of the Continental 48 and Hawaii and Alaska. Mm-hmm. We're talking everywhere, y'all. And so please go check out Dr. Ashley Farmer's amazing piece, which stamp of approval from Adam McNeil, ain't got no doctor on there yet, but it's coming, you know, wait for it. You know, at Black Perspectives, the award-winning blog of the African American Intellectual History Society. And this piece is called Archiving While Black. And before we let Dr. Farmer go, is there anything that is just burning you want to let the audience know, or even, you know, let's get a little update of what round four might look like for you on New Books in African American Studies?
Let's try to think. I don't think we covered everything, but yeah, stay tuned. Hopefully, at one point for you know, a biography of Queen Mother Moore, which is what I'm working on next. And it's an interesting kind of juxtaposition because she is, in fact, a woman that largely that lived for almost 100 years, but has virtually no archive in the traditional sense, right? In the way we think about it. So one of the things that I'm tackling in that book is how to talk about and document Black women's thoughts and movements in the absence of what we deem traditional archives, and how can these women help us kind of rethink the archive as a space.
Boom. And actually, you know what? You did mention just something that was interesting. Mm-hmm. The challenge. What's the biggest challenge you have with any of your projects, right? Not only archivally, but just what would you say your biggest challenge is just generally within any of your projects?
I would say that it is probably just locating archives. They're either spread really far out in a way, you know, I mean, for example, Queen Mother Moore, I find a snippet of a piece of paper here, a snippet of a piece of paper there, but that is speaking to our larger question of how do we collect Black women's lives and voices and thoughts. And honestly, also just funding to go do this kind of archival work. I think we have to work at different sites and in different ways. Because some of the stuff is not as easily collected as more traditional subjects or people. That is also thinking about one of the ways in which, you know, folks that do this kind of work are disadvantaged in the sense that, you know, archiving may take longer. It's certainly usually more expensive, and the repositories that the stuff might be found in are sometimes not always connected to big universities that can offer funding or, you know, space for that kind of work.
This is very true. This is very true. And you know what? I definitely look forward to this, you know, fourth iteration of your time on the podcast. And, you know, it's always a pleasure. And it's always an honor to have you on. And, you know, like I said, just like the Archive of Wild Black piece, you know, has done really well as far as clicks and downloads, I'm pretty sure that this interview is going to do the same. And so, Yes. Absolutely. And so, once again, folks, we have had the blessing and the honor to have one of my favorite guests, the person who's been on for three different times, and her name is Dr. Ashley Farmer, Assistant Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and History at the University of Texas at Austin. And so, folks, I am your host, Adam McNeil, from New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Over and out.